You're a busy provider trying to stay current with the latest HIV testing, prevention, and treatment guidelines, and your pockets are overflowing with note cards. You need a convenient, trustworthy source for HIV testing, treatment, prevention, and care protocols. All healthcare professionals have a role in stopping HIV. Introducing HIV Care Tools from the AIDS Education and Training Center program. The HIV Care Tools mobile app is simple, free, and fully functional offline or online. It features quick guides for HIV prevention, screening, testing, diagnosis, and treatment. HIV Care Tools provides common clinical calculators used in HIV management and provide validated screening tools for comorbidities such as depression, substance use disorders, and PTSD. And if you need clinician-to-clinician consultation, HIV Care Tools provides one-touch access to free clinical consultation services by a multidisciplinary team of experts. Take us with you. Download HIV Care Tools today.
Welcome to Nika in the Know, a podcast for healthcare providers in the HIV field. I'm Mariana Braitman. Today, I'm sitting down with Leanne Marco-Trigiano and Jani Basu to talk about structural competency in healthcare settings. Leanne is a family physician at La Clínica de la Raza and Highland Hospital, former HEAL Initiative Global Health Fellow, and Jani is third-year medical resident in psychiatry on the medical educator track at Zucker School of Medicine at Northwell Staten Island University Hospital. Welcome, Leanne and Jani.
Thanks, Mariana.
Happy to be here.
So let's just dive right in. Leanne, why should we be integrating structural competency into healthcare and medical education, especially now?
So we often refer to this quote by Barbara Major, the former director of the St. Thomas Health Clinic in New Orleans, that states, "No one has a right to work with poor people unless they have a real analysis of why people are poor." This is one way of framing the overarching goal of integrating structural competency into medical education. We want to develop an analysis of why certain people are poor while other people are not poor, or in some cases, exorbitantly wealthy, and by extension, why some people have much higher burdens of disease than others. Structural competency is a framework that we use to understand the relationship between racism, class, and illness. And over the years, medical education has used frameworks like cultural competency and social determinants of health to examine some of the ways in which seemingly extraclinical forces impact health. A structural framework sees social determinants of health and even culture as downstream effects of larger upstream structural forces. A healthcare system that lacks a structural analysis potentially runs the risk of providing care that's ineffective in the wider context, and risks maintaining or even contributing to health inequities.
Jani, can you talk a little bit about what social structures are for our listeners?
Yeah. So for our purposes, we define social structures as the policies, economic systems, and other institutions, like the judicial system, school system, et cetera, that have historically produced and continue to maintain modern social inequities and health disparities. And these disparities often fall along the lines of social categories like race, class, gender, sexuality, ability, things like that. One of the goals of structural competency training is to build a common vocabulary among clinicians and other healthcare workers so that we can better address the issues we do identify.
Leanne, how do social structures play into PrEP awareness?
That's a good question. In the training that Jani and I co-facilitated this last spring with Nika, we showed a CDC graph taken from a 2020 report by the Black AIDS Institute that shows rates of PrEP awareness, discussion, and use by race of 4,000 men who have sex with men from 23 different urban areas. We see that white men have consistently higher rates of PrEP awareness, discussion, and use when compared to Hispanic and Black men. And further, the differences in each category widen between white and non-white patients, showing that structural effects are often cumulative and nonlinear. When we think about what structures are at play here, naming structural racism is imperative. Tricia Rose from the Center for the Study of Race and Ethnicity defines structural racism as the normalization and legitimation of an array of dynamics, historical, structural, institutional, interpersonal, that routinely advantages whites while producing cumulative and chronic adverse outcomes for people of color. Data from the AHRQ shows that Black people in the US receive lower quality care than their white counterparts. And JAMA has found that non-white patients wait longer to see a medical provider. We also know that there's a lack of diversity within healthcare. So if you're non-white, it's less likely that your medical provider will be from the same racial or ethnic background as you.
Janie, what exactly is structural competency?
So the structural competency framework was developed in response to the identified lack of systematic training on structural factors in medical education and in healthcare training more broadly. Dr. Jonathan Metzl first proposed the concept of structural competency in his book titled The Protest Psychosis, How Schizophrenia Became a Black Disease, which was published in 2011. Dr. Metzl and his colleague, Dr. Helena Hansen, jointly proposed structural competency as a model for medical education in 2014. And they're both MDs, psychiatrists with PhDs in social sciences. The five core competencies, the word competency in air quotes, within this framework are one, recognizing the structures that shape clinical interactions, two, developing an extra clinical language of structure, three, rearticulating quote unquote cultural formulations and structural terms, four, observing and imagining structural interventions, and five, developing structural humility. As Drs. Hansen and Metzl clarify in their seminal paper on the topic, the word competency here doesn't imply a mastery over these complex and dynamic topics. The choice to use this word competency refers to its use in medical education to assess proficiency in other similarly huge topics like empathy or collaboration or scientific inquiry. It refers more to an orientation and a set of skills than an expertise per se. And that's why structural humility is emphasized in the closing.
So why do HIV care providers need to know about this?
Well, there are a dizzying number of structural elements that impact the health and well-being of people with HIV. Some examples that Leah and I spoke about in the presentation include the multiple complexities of needle exchange programs and safe injection sites, as well as a study showing that medical students with negative attitudes towards non-monogamy may make them less likely to prescribe PrEP in the future. Federal and local policies impact how and where needle exchange programs are set up, as well as how funding is received and maintained. The hidden curriculum in medical schools, how students learn some of the negative attitudes towards certain practices that then go on to perpetuate inequality. Structural competency has actually been incorporated into the AMA's health system science textbook and is often referred to as part of a systems-based practice. HIV care providers who are well-versed in structural analysis may be more equipped to advocate for and bring about structural changes that benefit their patients on more fundamental levels. In the example above, this could look like advocating for permanent funding for needle exchange programs and instituting interdisciplinary social medicine rounds to discuss the non-medical aspects of care, including addressing implicit biases.
Janie, how is inequality naturalized in healthcare and what can HIV care providers do about it?
Naturalizing inequality is a subtle and sometimes challenging concept to grasp, but it is nevertheless essential for healthcare professionals to understand it. It refers to the ways in which structural violence is ignored and made to seem natural, either by attributing disparities to nature or to individual behavior or culture, rather than to structural forces. Naturalizing inequality makes an inequitable and unjust status quo seem appropriate and deserved, which can contribute to its preservation. A good starting point is to understand how we all sometimes use implicit frameworks to explain patient behavior and how doing so contributes to naturalized inequality.
And what exactly are implicit frameworks?
So implicit frameworks emphasize individual behaviors, biology, and a misguided application of the term culture as explanation for inequities. The word implicit is being used here in the same way that it's used in the term implicit biases. So that's to say that implicit frameworks were never explicitly taught to us as a way of thinking, though sometimes they could be, nor are they necessarily a conscious decision. Rather, implicit frameworks are a way of thinking that has been ingrained in us through socialization. For example, in a case study we use in the training, some clinicians might attribute a patient's drinking to a racist stereotype that Latino or Mexican men drink too much and conclude that the patient's poor health is a result of his culture. This interpretation ignores the structural forces that contributed to the man drinking heavily in the first place, like limited and low-paying work, gentrification, and displacement. Another implicit framework is biology and genetics. For example, someone could claim that the man was drinking because of a biological predisposition to alcoholism. And this claim is often falsely made about Indigenous communities. In fact, some Indigenous populations have higher prevalence of alcohol metabolism genes that protect against alcoholism. The misguided focus on predisposing genetics can prevent recognition of the role of hundreds of years of ongoing oppression, including history of genocide and land dispossession, which contributes to higher rates of alcoholism and just generally worse health outcomes in these communities. And it is important to note that biology and genetics and individual behavior and choices, and in some instances, culture as well, can and do matter for health. This discussion of implicit frameworks doesn't deny the significance of these factors for individual and community health. The key takeaway is just that these factors tend to be overemphasized, which distracts from noticing and discussing and attempting to change the structural injustices that are the primary drivers of health disparities.
Leanne, what is the concept of beloved community and how does it relate to structural competency?
So Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Popularized the term beloved community during the civil rights movement, and it has since become a tenet of many social justice movements. Shirley Strong, a social justice educator who is one of the core members of our group, the Bay Area Structural Competency Working Group, defines beloved community as an inclusive, interconnected consciousness based on love, justice, compassion, responsibility, power, and a deep respect for all people, places, and things that radically transform individuals and restructures institutions. And we use beloved community in our work and in our trainings as a key element within structural competency because it highlights the importance of individual transformation and systematic change together and at once, and being community with people in support of both.
Leanne, as we begin to wrap up, how can HIV care providers apply these principles in their care practices?
So we explicitly encourage providers to learn about their patients, the neighborhoods, and their colleagues to bring their specific power and the respect they receive as clinicians to work together to support structural change. One example is the Flint water crisis in Michigan, of how patients' voices, community members, and the power of a medical provider led to a huge public health response. We outline many other examples in our training, and we ask providers and those within healthcare to consider what changes, both big and small, might be possible that could improve care. In addition, there are some other sort of beloved community tenets that can kind of help with application of the concept. We use these objectives that are learn about the history and culture of the communities we serve, recognize our interdependence, work in partnership to advance the well-being of others, use our strengths and our privileges to intervene on injustice in solidarity across difference, to listen and lead with our hearts, and to create spaces that support intellectual honesty, deep dialogue, solidarity, and structural interventions.
Leanne, Janie, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about structural competency in healthcare settings and why this is such an important topic for HIV care providers. We really hope you learned something new today. To learn more about NECA AATC's work and our role in ending the HIV epidemic, visit us at www.necaaatc.org. That's www.necaaatc.org. If you have questions or comments about anything we covered today, or if you have suggestions for topics you'd like to hear us talk about, don't hesitate to email us at podcast@necaaatc.org. That's podcast@necaaatc.org. Stay safe, and we'll see you on Thursday for our next episode of NECA in the Know. This presentation is supported by the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS. The contents are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of, nor an endorsement by, HRSA, HHS, or the U.S. government.